Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Weekly Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Breton. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting three comics that came out in shops last week, but that John and I got from DCBS this week. One from DC, one from Marvel, and one from some other publisher. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be talking about in this episode were originally released on December 19th, 2007. And if I don't sound like I usually do, that's because I've practically died over the holidays. Got a nasty cold and stuff, which I'm still not totally over, but I'm starting to feel better. How are you doing, Bob?
I got the same cold and cough and thing. Probably not as bad as yours, but it's there, and it's probably affecting my voice a little bit, too.
I tell you, the temperature out here has been dropping to, like, below freezing at night and getting up to about 60 in the day, and it's just insane. So, but enough about that. This was about an average week for me. Got about 34 comics, one magazine, one book, and because I was off from work, I've actually read everything. How big of a week was it for you?
36 comics. I got three hardcovers, two regular trade paperbacks, three of those classic Marvel figurines, and the Ms. Tree mass market paperback, her first mass market paperback story by Max Collins.
Interesting.
So I thought that was kind of cool. I remember reading the Ms. Tree comics way back when from whoever published that. I think they were originally out from Aardvark Vanaheim, or I don't even remember exactly who, but it's been a long time. And when I saw that there was a paperback coming out, you know, from the Hard Case Crime series, I'll give it a try. So I'll have to give it a read.
Cool. I never read the original stuff from the original publisher, but I did pick up the Mystery Quarterly that DC did way back, and that was pretty good. Yeah, the magazine I got was the Modern Masters Frank Cho. The book was an art book and stuff. Most of what I got, though, standard run-of-the-mill comics, nothing too exciting.
Yeah, so actually I did pick up that Frank Cho book at the shop, so I can add that in. I also got the Hulk versus Fin Fang Foom special that came out in a couple of X-Men books. I decided after all you were talking about the Messiah Complex to pick up those, and when it's finally out, I will read the entire Messiah Complex in one go.
That's a good plan.
And we can talk about it, the storyline, when the last part comes out.
That's a good plan. I think it reads better back-to-back. I read the issue of New X-Men that came out this week, and that was, again, a week after I'd read everything else. And, you know, it flowed pretty well, but not having all that momentum, having just read everything else, it's one that, I don't know, I guess too many comics are reading better in trade these days that it gets a little depressing. I remember when everything used to read just fine as monthly issues.
Right. But something that read just fine as a monthly issue was our first book of the week, Checkmate number 21. I enjoyed this as the issue, and it's the first part of, I don't know, maybe a two-part story, or maybe even more, featuring Mademoiselle Marie, and boy, I read it. Good chunk of story, and it had me excited to see part two when it comes out next month.
It's nice to see them building up kind of a bit of a new mythos, leveraging some of the older stories that they had told over the years with Mademoiselle Marie character. And it was good, but what got me is we didn't see that much of the rest of the Checkmate group, you know what I mean? We got introduced to the new Black Queen.
The new White Queen, replacing Amanda Waller.
That's right. And this is the one who was Negative Woman in the Doom Patrol?
Correct.
I thought that was a very interesting choice. And I'm assuming at this point she no longer has powers?
I would imagine so, because they kind of make a point with the Royals that one has powers and one doesn't. And Sasha Bordeaux has powers, so.
All in all, it was an interesting issue. It just seemed enough disconnected with everything else going on in the DC Universe at the moment that I was a little puzzled as to why they chose now to tell this story. I didn't have any problems with the story. I had just expected to see a little bit more tying in with, say, Salvation Run, what's going on in Suicide Squad, and some of those things. And, again, that was more my expectations than anything else. And not a knock against the story at all. This was good. I liked some of the flashback scenes they did to earlier people who went under this codename. But, again, the fact that it didn't tie in with everything else going on in the DC Universe just felt a little off, given how interconnected a lot of other titles are right now.
I guess I didn't have that expectation going into it, so I just read it as I was kind of interested in the backstory around the Mademoiselle Marie character. You get introduced to Mademoiselle Marie's throughout history, and Mademoiselle Marie from looks like the one from World War II, or at least one of the ones from World War II. They're like making mention of the fact that, you know, they had a pretty high mortality rate on Mademoiselle Marie's during World War II, but at least the last one from World War II is, you know, they kind of had a flashback to where she was handing over the reins to Josephine Tautain there and all of that. So I kind of looked at it as, you know, this is a good story as a story.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, and I like how they're, again, building up another kind of a legacy hero here. And this is one which could easily, you know, establish strong ties with, say, the JSA and some other stuff like that, just in terms of the nature of the background.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, sure, they didn't have a whole lot of checkmate stuff in this issue. I mean, they had a little bit of stuff, a little bit of checkmate intrigue and stuff, but it wasn't like the main focus of this particular issue. It was mostly focusing it on this one character and her backstory. Knowing that going in, it does seem like it would be a good, interesting jump on point for someone who hasn't read the story before, maybe is interested in that character, because it isn't steeped in a lot of continuity. You don't need to know a lot to get into this particular issue.
Agreed. And the main story focuses so much on that character, you get a complete story, a lot of background and establishment of that character, and you do get enough of the other checkmate stuff to get kind of introduced to that as it's going on. So it's a good mix of a full story plus introduction to checkmate that this could make a very good intro issue for somebody.
Right.
I would agree with that. And anyone who likes how they do the flashback scenes in either Iron Fist, how they used to do that, where else did they used to do that? A bit in Starman, a bit in Hawkman, the Angel TV series. I think anyone who likes that kind of storytelling would probably enjoy this issue too.
Right.
All in all, it was a good issue. I was very happy with it. I had just, you know, been expecting, like I said, a little more interplay with some of the other stuff. But we've gotten enough of that in recent issues of Checkmate that them taking a time to do more of a standalone story makes perfect sense.
And maybe that's what they were thinking, too. I mean, after that whole Fall of the Wall series, I mean, that was pretty much very steeped in Checkmate-y kind of goodness. And they got rid of Amanda Waller, and now she's got free reign to run around over in Suicide Squad again. So this one kind of like taking a step back a little bit.
Yeah, cool.
So Immortal Iron Fist number 11, The Seven Capital Cities of Heaven, round 4.
Overall, I would say, while this was a very good issue, it wasn't as good as some of the ones that have come right before it. But part of that is this book has just been doing so great. You know, Brubaker and Fraction have really solidified and built up a huge mystique and background for the Iron Fist character that is just mind-boggling, particularly when you compare it against the last Iron Fist series that lasted like 8 issues and nobody really noticed when it just kind of stopped. I'm loving this series, and this was an excellent issue. It just felt, I don't know, I'd been expecting a bit more of kind of like a huge action sequence or whatever, and we got some action, don't get me wrong.
It was a middle issue.
Yeah.
You know, it's issue 4 of, I don't know, 6 or 7 issue arc, whatever it's going to end up being. And while it was a great story in and of itself for people who are liking Iron Fist, I don't think it's a great jump on issue. You know, if someone's not been reading Iron Fist, they probably shouldn't pick up this particular issue as their first one. It does look like at the end there that, you know, something's certainly going to be happening next issue.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a regular reader of the issue, I mean, of the series, rather, it certainly gives a good chunk of story. Lots of stuff happens in this issue. You know, there's some action, there's the story moving forward, and it leaves you with, you know, definitely with a hook of, boy, I want to get the next issue. So it succeeds on all those counts. It's just, it kind of picks up the story in progress, and for someone who's just wandering in, you know, off the street and has never read the title before, they should probably go back and try to find the back issues and start at the beginning of the Seven Capital Cities of Heaven.
Yeah. Actually, I would say they should. I mean, the series is new enough. I mean, we're only on issue 11 here. They should go ahead and pick up the first trade. And because I think that it all really builds and stuff. And once you've got that context, this is a good issue. And, you know, you're right. It's definitely, you know, middle issue of story kind of a thing. It hits the ground running and keeps going. It gives you enough that, you know, even with all the stuff I read, I didn't feel the least bit lost or anything of the sort. But while it gave a huge chunk of story here, it didn't have the huge resolution and ending chapter would have, or the huge establishment stuff that a beginning chapter would have. It had a little of both kind of stuff in here. Part of it, though, is, again, going back to kind of what were my expectations going into this issue. Some of the ones recently have just been so great, so much fun, some really interesting fight scenes, some really interesting background on the Kunlun city and stuff like that. And this was more progressing the story versus you know, establishing new parts of the mythos or things like that. And there was nothing wrong with it. It was an excellent story and stuff. It's just, it's got a higher benchmark for it to hit for me to consider it as good as some of the previous issues.
But at the same time, I mean, even an off issue of this series is better than a good issue of a lot of other series. So don't take any of that criticism, you know, listeners, as anything bad, because it's still an excellent issue. And Brubaker and Fraction do an excellent job telling a story in the series.
Exactly, exactly. I wouldn't even say this was an off issue. It just didn't fire on all cylinders. You know, it was damn close to that, though. You know what I mean? And I really can't put my finger on exactly what I felt was missing. But I would put this above, you know, most of the other stuff I'm reading these days. This is an excellent thing, and if you're the least bit interested in Iron Fist, you really should be reading this title. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and anyone who likes kind of like the street level heroes or in the Marvel Universe, any kind of martial arts kind of stuff, this is really a good series to be picking up on a regular basis.
Well, and again, Brubaker and Fraction treat this character with so much respect that, you know, it's really cool. They're playing up the history of the character. They're using the parts of the character's continuity that make sense, not dissing any of the rest of it. Frankly, with this character, there's a couple of parts that are kind of best forgotten in previous series.
Which you can actually draw parallels between this and the Mademoiselle Marie character now. You know, they're making Mademoiselle Marie into a legacy character through the history of France, in much the way that Iron Fist has been made in this series into a legacy history character, where, you know, there have been multiple Iron Fists for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And Danny Rand is just the latest one of them. You know, they're doing the same kind of thing with Mademoiselle Marie now over in Checkmate, which is an interesting take on it, and I like the way they're doing it in both of those series. So
yeah.
Very recommended book. If you're not picking it up, it's worth a read.
Definitely.
And next issue that we're talking about is Neozoic number 2 from Red 5 Comics. This is just another shining star in the stable from Red 5. I mean, they're more and more solidifying to be the, you know, Valiant or cross-gen. I look more as a cross-gen, because cross-gen, they had the sigils that kind of tied all the books together, but the books didn't all, like, cross over into one another in the universes. You know, it's like when you read cross-gen, Meridian was Meridian, and Sojourn was a completely separate book, and Scion was a completely separate book, and you had science fiction books and fantasy books and, you know, kind of superhero-y kind of books, but they were all good books, and they had that one sigil kind of thing that sort of tied them together, but there wasn't really a lot of cross-continuity. You know, you look at Valiant, they were all in the same universe, and they were trying to do kind of like a Marvel or DC kind of universe. This one, you know, with Red 5, they just tell pretty damn good stories, you know, that aren't related to one another, but they're really good. And this one was no exception. I mean, it's a number 2 issue. I tried to read this as a standalone. They had the little intro thing on the inside front cover that kind of brought you up to speed. I thought that was good. It felt to me like if I hadn't read issue 1, I could pretty much pick up into the story with this issue.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And it told a decent story, the beginning, middle, and end. It had a good hook on that last page. You know, it's like, wow, you know, I want to see the next issue. The art style is different than almost any other book that I'm reading. And I read a lot of different books, but I really like this art style. It's a very kind of clean, interesting, almost painted looking style. They had that sketchbook section in the back for a couple of pages. That was pretty cool. Overall, I love this book. This is another winner from these guys.
I would say for me, it's probably my favorite Red 5 book. And I'm really loving all the other ones too. But there's something about the art style that's got a kind of a unique look to it, again, across all the comics I'm reading as well. The coloring is a nice, I don't want to say vibrant, because there are a couple of pages where, you know, everything's in earth tones and stuff like that. But they can do that kind of, I don't want to say monochromatic feel to it.
It's subdued. It's subdued. Yeah. It's not in-your-face coloring, but it's not, it doesn't feel like they're, you know, some books, like, they have that kind of monochromatic dark look. This one, on the outside scenes, it seems like it's a brightly lit daytime scene. You know, when it's at night, it seems like it's at night, and it's a little darker, but you still get a color palette.
Yeah.
But it's not like that kind of in-your-face primary color, you know, kind of, yeah, you know, kind of superhero-y kind of color palette. It's a very subdued, natural kind of color. So they do a good job on that.
Yeah, there's a subtlety to the coloring. Like, if you go to the middle of the book where you see the high temple of the Triady or whatever, and you see the shot of the temple, most of it has got kind of a brownish, reddish kind of a color to it with different levels of light and stuff. And there are a lot of books I read where if this scene were to be colored like that, it would be kind of hard to make out where the temple is in the thing. But there's, a subtlety here to the lighting and shading and stuff like that. Everything is really clear what's going on, and the art, the colors, everything works really nicely together. And, you know, I mean, the subject matter itself differentiates it from most of the rest of what I'm reading, because I don't read that many other books, if any, that have, you know, the whole dinosaurs, humans running around. But this is just, I don't know, it's almost got a anime or cartoon kind of a feel in places, and I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, just in the simple lines of the art. It's not over-rendered.
Yeah.
You know, same thing where the color is very subtle. You have the art. The art's crisp, clean. It's line art for the most part. And the coloring, and that's what, you know, you look at that same center page, flip to the other side, right?
Yeah.
Where you have Lily talking, and look at her face in that upper right-hand panel. What they've done with the color there is they've used the colorist, Jessie Lamb, I think, is the colorist. She's done an excellent job, kind of like Maury Hollowell does on, like, the Civil War or something, where the color is adding the dimension and the shading and all of that to the facial features. It's not over-rendered with line art, putting that emotion and shading and substance to the face, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference here, is that you're leveraging the colorist to really, you know, the colorist here is, you know, the color artist. They're not just adding color. They're adding a lot of form, substance, and tone to this series. And you see that on most of these things. Just the shadowing, the shading, and a lot of things like that are added through the color process to especially people's faces.
I'd really like to see what the art looks without the color, because I agree the color is adding a lot to this book. Yet, unlike some books where that's definitely the case, and I'm thinking Ultimate Fantastic Four and stuff like that, in those cases, without the color, I don't think you got much left. In this, I think it's a good balance between the line work and the color. The line work, I think, really defines a lot of it, and that color just adds to that, again, with the sense of depth, the sense of, again, subtlety. There's, again, with those faces on those pages there, the use of the coloring really adds the dimension to it in a kind of a subtle way where it's not, gee, without the color, there wouldn't be any art there kind of thing. It's a really nice blend.
They're acknowledging that because you look at the cover and it says Enns/Corum/Lamb.
Yeah.
And the script is by Paul Enns, the art is by Jay Corum, and the colors are by Jesse Lamb. So the colorist is getting cover credit on this book. So I think, you know, they're acknowledging the fact that she's adding, she or he, I don't know, Jesse's kind of a, could be a guy or a girl, but they're adding quite a lot of substance to this book. And, you know, this particular story, they've brought in various political intrigues. They're adding a little bit more to the structure of the city. You get this Triady kind of spelled out a little more. You've got this political unrest with the people who are against the, you know, indiscriminate killing of the dinosaurs, you know, kind of like the environmentalists. You got Lily going to the temple, and you get some of the stuff with her father and sister and how that going out. You get the family of this other guy, Ross. You got this little girl who appears to be some like different kind of race and what's going to be going on with that got brought into the series, and just all kinds of stuff. And you can see that, you know, they've added these things in a very good way.
Yeah, yeah.
To the series, where the story moved along, very clear storytelling, panel to panel. I mean, the art, to me, you know, you got very clear what's going on. The captions and are playing very well together. And again, I got a new chunk of story. I learned more about the world, moved it along to a point, and then left it on a very good cliffhanger that's like, wow, I can't wait to see what happens next issue.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that I left the first issue with was a definite desire to explore this world further. And in this issue, they did a great job of doing that. We got to kind of walk around in this world, learn a lot about the city, the politics, the religion, like you said, while not doing that at the expense of the story, but in a way that really helped build the story. And there's a sophistication to the storytelling here that I'm really enjoying. I mean, they can go for a couple of panels without dialogue and stuff and really move the story along. I think they've got a lot here that I think they're planning on telling us over time. There are a couple of subtle things that we just see kind of in the background. Oh, wow, that's how they've got kind of the outer perimeter with an electrified fence or whatever. And they've also got a couple of things where they've got a lot of dialogue going out because somebody's giving a speech. Yet when I read it, it didn't feel like there was, oh gosh, all this expository dialogue or anything. And it's really not until now when I'm looking back through it, where a couple of pages in, you've got the one guy talking about the politics and stuff right after Lily gets back in the city. And I mean, he's got paragraph-long dialogue balloon.
It didn't feel like exactly. It kind of flowed. Just like you have pages 2, 3, 4, and 5 here, where she's doing the fight with the big dinosaur, and there's barely any dialogue at all on those pages. And it was pretty clear what was going on. You could follow panel to panel what was going on, and I didn't get lost at all. And that's to the credit of Jay Corum, because there are a lot of artists, when they're challenged to tell a story, sequential storytelling for 3 to 5 pages with minimal dialogue, that, and maybe it's my loss, but a lot of times I get lost, you know, and it's like I can't tell what's going on. On this one, it's very clear, very easy to follow, very well done. You know, they did an excellent job of that in this issue, and I appreciate that. You know, and it's not that it's dumbed down or anything. I don't think of myself as a stupid person, and I've been reading for a long time, but I mean, just it plays right into that. You know, it's just not something where it's like really difficult to follow. It just flows.
Yeah, this is something that has highly effective storytelling, both in the writing, the art, the coloring. I would even say the lettering in places. This is a very highly competent and talented creative team on this book, and that's part of why I'm enjoying it. It's a very different kind of a comic, and it's exceedingly well done. And we've gone on record as pretty much recommending virtually I would say everything that Red 5 has put out, we basically, I think at the moment, have a kind of de facto thumbs up on.
Yeah.
And this would be at the top of the list for me.
Yeah. Red 5 has not made a misstep in picking a series yet, and this is certainly one of their top books. I mean, this is an excellent, excellent book. And again, I'd like to applaud Red 5, because you look at this book, $2.95. It's got beautiful, high-quality paper, excellent production values.
Yeah.
I mean, this looks nicer than any Marvel or DC book that comes out, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
And they've got a cardstock cover. This is a beautiful package that they've put together for the same price that Marvel and DC put out. You know, whereas, you know, some of the other smaller publishers, you're getting a black and white book, and it's like 50 cents or a dollar more. You know, this is a beautiful full-color production, and I don't know how they're doing it, but I appreciate how they're doing it, and I hope they keep on doing it.
Yeah.
And everyone out there is listening, go buy yourself a Red 5 comic, because this is some good stuff, and in particular, pick up Neozoic.
I can't recommend this one highly enough either, and this is one that, you know, I hope they keep around for the long term. I would love to read the 50th or 100th issue of this title at some point in the future, because I think they're going to have a really rich narrative universe in there that'll be very well developed, very accessible, and just very entertaining. Definite thumbs up.
Yeah, it really does bring me back to how I felt when I was reading one of those first issues of Sojourn or Meridian or Scion, you know?
Well, and I think the cross-gen comparison's a very good one, because with cross-gen, each of their books was kind of a different genre or whatever, and we're getting a lot of that with Red 5. We're getting kind of the straight-up superhero stuff with Midnight. We're getting more the, I don't want to say fantasy-type thing, but, you know, with Neozoic, kind of the alternate history kind of a thing. We're getting more the satirical superhero slant in Abyss. We're going to get more of a harder sci-fi kind of a thing, I think, in Afterburn. You know, they've got a good kind of diversity. Not all their books are just the same. They're very different. Each has a unique identity. And I think that's going to really work out well for Red 5. You were wanting to talk about one other comic this week?
Yeah, you know, Raph, who's Wraithmaker on the forum, pointed out this storyline, The Long Count, when it was in preview several months ago, and I ordered it. It seemed to be a really intriguing concept. You know, it's kind of like a cyberpunk future based on Mayan culture instead of, you know, a lot of these have like kind of an oriental sort of culture in them as the dark future. And then there's also this Mayan belief that in 2012, the world's going to end. And, you know, I don't know a whole lot about that, but it's interesting to me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to pick this up. Well, I mean, I got the first issue of this, and flipping through it, the art's beautiful. Page by page, panel by panel, I love the art in it. But then when I got into reading the story was just, a lot of the things I was saying about Neozoic just didn't fall true here. I mean, it was like, there's the whole concept of this 2012 and all this kind of stuff, and I didn't, reading this one issue, I didn't get any of that from this. I don't know if it's something lacking in me or what, but if I would not have read the blurbs on this, if I wouldn't listen to the interview that the creators of this book did with the CGS guys over on CGS, none of the great concept and story that this book is going to ultimately hold, I assume, was actually brought across to me in the actual story that's on the page in this first issue. And same thing, whereas the art in and of itself, page to page, is beautiful to look at, the sequential storytelling of the book, and it's a new artist, so I'm sure she'll get better at this, but I mean, it was just, the coloring was, to me, it didn't seem to add to the story as much. It was, there was a really long action sequence here with no dialogue where I was really kind of struggling as to what the heck was going on. It's the main character, Sandoval is, I think, her name. She's fighting some big Mayan tiki-looking guy, and just cut scenes and black, I don't know if that's blood or black energy or what shooting around, but I'm like, I'm reading this and it's like, what the heck is going on? And there's dialogue panels that, you know, they sprinkle in Spanish and English, which I normally don't have a problem with, but some of these, they had some stuff that were just eluded me as to what the hell it meant. And I even went to Babelfish and translated it, and I still couldn't figure out what the hell was going on with some of this stuff. And it's just the storytelling. It seemed to me, I had the same feeling reading this as I had when I read the first issue of that Moon Knight series.
Yeah.
By David Finch, and who's the writer who came in to do that from the novels? I forget. But, I mean, it's like, you know, it's basically, this is a six-issue series. I think they have a couple of six-issue series planned with some interstitial issues in between the two. I'm assuming that maybe once you read the whole thing, it will make sense. But everything that I was saying about Neozoic, where they told me a complete story, got me to a certain point, and made me want to read the next issue, that didn't happen with this one. On this one, if I had not heard interviews from the creators and been interested in the concept as a whole, there'd be nothing causing me to come back and want to read the second issue of this. If I just walked into a store, picked this issue up off the shelf, because it's got a really cool cover, and it does have a really nice cover, I could pick this up and read it, and I would get pretty much none of that rich tapestry of story.
I would have to agree with that entirely, because that's exactly what I did. I have not listened to interviews with the creator. I have not read a whole lot about this book. I remember it being talked about on our previews call, and what I got out of this book, because I picked it up because you wanted to talk about it, is you've got this girl, Sandoval, running across town, getting into some fights, and, you know, getting to wherever she's getting to with the video images of Quetzal or whatever, and it reminded me of the issue of All-Star Batman and Robin, where Batman drives across town in the Batmobile with Robin, except no Batman, no high-profile, you know, interesting characters, and no high-profile, interested and talented creators. This was an okay issue, but it was highly ineffective in telling the story. There was nothing about the whole Mayan countdown to the end of the world kind of a thing in the story that I could find. I agree entirely that the art is not bad, but it is not effective in telling the story, and I don't know how much of that to blame on the art versus the coloring, because it's too monochromatic. Everything just kind of blurs. There's no sense of foreground, middle ground, and background kind of depth to the art.
Yeah, there's no colorist listed, so I'm assuming that the artist is doing her own coloring on this.
Well, it needs a new colorist.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like you listen to the interview, and there's like a whole bunch of, you know, you see she's running along, and it's like depends on what your familiarity with some of this stuff is. She's got what looks to be a big Hyalai glove kind of thing on her one arm, and so she's apparently, and she's got a number on her chest, so she's apparently a professional sports person. You know, they've got kind of like a poster on the wall on the one page where it looks like she's known as something, but it's kind of all hinted at. In, you know, they would have done well to put some kind of framing sequence or something in here where they at least introduce you to this world, introduce you to the 2012 thing, introduce you to what's going on and why you should really give a good goddamn about this. I'm sorry, you know, it's like I got none of that out of this issue, and it's just it kind of ran along through the issue. And again, as individual disjoint images, the visuals were very nice to look at. But the storytelling was very lacking, and I just didn't. This is a bi-monthly book, you know. It's not gripping me. It's not saying, "Boy, I've got to come back and read issue number two of this book." And I'm sorry. I really wanted to like this issue, but the execution of it was way below where I needed it to be to get me to come back for issue number two.
Yeah, again, I would agree with that. I mean, on page three, we get the crux of this issue where she's got 20 minutes to go meet the dragon. It's all over. So the whole thing is her racing across town. And then at the end, I can't tell if she really made it in time or not. And there's nothing about the ending that really pulls me into the next issue. It was muddled storytelling, art, and coloring. And they may have a brilliant idea behind all this, but if it's not in the execution, if it's not in the story, if it's not in the pages of the comic, I don't care.
It reminded me a lot of a European comic.
Yes.
You know, that you see in like these heavy metal hardcover albums and stuff. And as a complete album, and Arkea has a history of putting together very beautiful hardcover collections. This might be okay as a collection, and that's probably what I'll do. I mean, I'm not going to buy another bi-monthly issue of this.
Yeah.
When it's all collected, I might get the collection. You know, theoretically, I'll get a complete story from that, but this really didn't do a good job of moving the story along and telling what I like to call a satisfying chunk of story in an issue. I mean, it's kind of like, did she make it across town in the 20 minutes? And why exactly did she have to make it across town in 20 minutes? You know, well, I wasn't bought into that because it was like that one caption is like, I have 20 minutes to get there or else it's all over. You know, it's like, well, okay, well, what's at stake? You know, is it somebody's going to die? Something bad's going to happen? You know, what's your motivation? It's just, none of that was there.
Yeah. And, you know, as ineffective as the storytelling was, as weak as the premise in this comic was conveyed, I would be okay with that if there was something about it that intrigued me on some level, either the character, the setting, the background, something. But it failed to engage me in the story. It failed to hook me in any way, shape, or form. And, I mean, like, when we talked about the first issue of Simon Dark, I had some reservations, whatever, but there was something about it that intrigued me. It's like, okay, I do want to know more about that character. I don't care about Sandoval. I don't care if she made it in time or not across town. And if it's all over, that's just fine by me.
Well, that's where they failed. You know, it's like they didn't put that in here. And again, unless you have listened to these interviews or read some article somewhere, you get none of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like this is the kind of thing where inside front cover, put a page of text that tells you what the hell's going on and why you should give a shit. You know, it's like it doesn't have to be built into the story pages necessarily, but it has to be in this comic that I pick up and I'm reading. And, I mean, you read the back cover of it, and it says, it has the thing, you know, it says, you know, through its rich and varied history, the land has remained in the hands of people. So to believe in the end of the Mayan calendar, the end of the world, its mythology, superstition, they claim, and even the warnings of the great dragon, Quetzalcoatl, have not changed their mind. You know, and they make reference to this, but even that's done in a very oblique fashion. I mean, it's not, it's kind of like a general setting, but not like anything specific. about, okay, Carmen Sandoval has returned home to save her friend, to save her city, to save her world. There's more to her story and her history than she ever knew. She's about to be burdened with a terrible and righteous task, et cetera, et cetera. Putting that on the back cover, first off, was a big mistake. They should have put it on the inside of the front cover, because a lot of times you don't go and read the back cover before you read the story. Execution-wise, poorly done by Arkea.
Well, I would say that back cover has more story than the inside of the comic, and that's in and of itself pretty bad. It's certainly much more informative as to what the comic should be about than the actual comic was, and that's inexcusable and unforgivable. I mean, it sounds like they've got a good concept, a interesting story to tell. They just failed to tell the story interestingly. So I was disappointed with this.
So, I mean, constructive criticism to Jason Blair, if he ever stumbles across this, is take what's on the back cover of the book, stick it on the inside of the front cover.
Yeah.
A. B, take some of those concepts that are introduced in this blurb and weave them into the narrative of your first issue in captions or something, so that you're letting people know, you're not just dropping them in the middle of something. You want them to be introduced to a fair chunk of the backstory of the thing in a first issue. And that's very important in a first issue if you expect to sell it as issues serialized bi-monthly or monthly or whatever.
Right.
You know, if you're writing this as a single trade, not as important, because I'm going to get to the story as I get to the story. But you're not writing a trade here. You're writing issue 1 of 6. That's what the problem was.
Yeah. And then also, you know, you need a better coloring and art to get a sense of foreground and background in it. It needs to be a lot clearer as to what's going on. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't say it was the worst comic I've read, because it's not. I've read much worse. But it failed to hook me with the first issue. And I see no point in coming back for the other 5 or even a collected edition. And I like to think I'm something of an easy sell when it comes to comics.
I'm intrigued enough about the main idea that if people out on the forums are raving about the series as it completes, that I'll maybe pick up the collected edition. Because, I mean, again, hearing the stuff that's not in this package, I'm very interested.
I'm intrigued enough by the concept, I may look at Wikipedia's article on the Mayan calendar and the superstition of the end of the world. That's the extent of my intrigue.
Yeah.
And I think I'll get a better story there than I'm getting in this comic, and that's bad. So, and I don't mean to slam on these guys. They seem to be trying to tell a good story. They just needed to polish it up a bit more before they released it. You know, I think it was potentially salvageable, but whoever edited the book should have given them more feedback and should have pushed them a little harder to tighten it up.
That's actually a good point. You know, it's like I would not expect a new author, and again, I don't know what else Jason Blair has done, but I mean, these are mistakes that somebody can make, but this is the kind of stuff that I would expect an editor to have enough input into something to say, hey, you know, this issue is kind of unclear, and it's the editor who should have been putting, you know, this on the inside of the front cover instead of on the back cover, and it's the editor who should have been saying, hey, Jason, you know, why don't you weave some of these things somewhere into the story so people know what the hell's going on? You know, it's just, you know, there's more to being an editor than checking for misspellings. That's the bottom line there.
Yeah.
I think that if the editor did a better job, this book could have been several orders of magnitude better.
Yeah.
And there's actually an art editor listed on the credits too, an art director.
Really?
So at Arkea, there's a Pauline Benny, art director. You know, it's like, and I would have expected the art director to say, hey, you know, this coloring, not doing it. You know, this sequence is not clear. And maybe it was clear to the art director. Maybe the art director is a lot smarter than I am on picking this stuff up, but they need to put themselves into the shoes of a normal person here. And it's like, hey, maybe we can throw a couple of captions in here to, like, you know, kind of lead someone through. But then again, there's a school of thought that, you know, hey, we're making art, and if you can't understand our art, you know, that's your hard luck. You know, don't read our book. And I think that's where I'm falling on this one.
That's certainly where I'm falling, and it won't surprise me if when we see the sales numbers on this, to see a sharp drop between issues 1 and 2. I mean, sharper than normal, which is too bad. Because again, it seems like they've got a good concept, they just couldn't get it into the book, at least in the first issue. Hopefully it'll pick up and get better for anyone who sticks around for future issues.
Join us next week when we discuss Legion of Superheroes number 37 from DC, Ultimate Power number 9 from Marvel, and Proof number 3 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. thanks for listening.